Thanks for listening to the AM 620 KPOJ podcast, sponsored by the Better World Club, providing travel services, auto insurance, and 24/7 nationwide roadside assistance, but not part of the highway lobby. This is Tom Hartman, Better World Club member since first moving to Oregon. Check out their eco benefits like the nation's only bicycle roadside assistance and their e-newsletter, Kicking Asphalt, at betterworldclub.com.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And a beautiful Friday it is. Shabbat Shalom, Jumma Mubarak, TGIF, whatever it may be for you. By the way, in our second hour, we're going to be asking, how do you deal with junk email spam? Among other things. Of course, it's Anything Goes Friday. We've got a whole bunch of political issues as well to bounce off of you. But we're going to be giving away a copy of my book, Walking Your Blues Away, How to Heal the Mind and Create Emotional Well-Being, as that contest. So I just wanted to give you a heads up on that. And Senator Bernie Sanders is with us in our first hour, as always. It is our national town hall. Bernie will be taking your calls at 866-303-2270. And Bernie, I got a bit of kind of bragging rights news. I wanted to share it with you. I haven't shared it with my listeners yet. You're the first. Are you there? Good morning.
I am right here, Tom. Great. Let's hear the news.
Okay. Talkers Magazine, which is the Bible of the talk radio industry. It is the publication. They put on a big annual conference in June in New York and the whole thing, and they've been around forever. They do an annual ranking. They call it the Heavy 100, the top 100 talk show hosts in America. And they ranked me this year as the number 10 talk show host in America. The nine above me are all conservatives, you know, Limbaugh, Hannity, Savage, that bunch. And thus I am the number one progressive talk show host in America, according to Talkers Magazine.
Well, Tom, it's interesting that you mentioned that because I'm calling you today from California. And I was in San Francisco the other day. I was in Santa Ana and I was in L.A. just yesterday. And I got to tell you, now, obviously, I travel in fairly select circles here, but so many people came up to me telling me that they listen to your show and that they appreciate your show. So it doesn't shock me that you're doing that well. Congratulations on,
thank you, all of your efforts. You know, that'll be the end of my breaking my arm to pat my back. I just, you know, I'm not.
But let's stay on the issue for a moment. But yeah. I'll tell you why I want to stay on it. I think that the issue of media in general, I think the issue of talk radio is an enormously important issue that we as progressives have got to focus more on. You mentioned that the top nine are all conservative. What you also know is that, in fact, nine out of ten of talk radio shows all over this country are right-wing shows.
Yeah.
In a country which is moving more and more progressive, and there's something fundamentally wrong there. And this is an issue that we have got to continue to focus on. We're making a little bit of progress. But the truth is, we need a lot more progressive voices out there all over America. It is totally absurd that there are communities in this country which are overwhelmingly anti-Republican who only receive right-wing talk shows.
Yeah, it is, and it's something that I look forward to future conversations with you and others about. In fact, we did an hour on this show 2 days ago on that topic, and we will continue.
But I just want the listeners to know that when we talk about progressive politics, understand the importance of media, understand what is discussed, what is not discussed, and why it is that on talk radio, the overwhelming number of shows are right-wing. That's not an accident.
Yeah.
That's not a clamoring on the part of grassroots America that says, give me more Rush Limbaugh, give me more Sean Hannity. I don't think so. There are other factors involved, and that's an issue that we have got to continue to pursue.
Indeed. So what's on your plate today, Bernie?
Well, I think the issue, you know, Tom, that is on everybody's plate right now is the state of the economy, the understanding that we're in a very deep recession. I see it in Vermont. I'm seeing it here in California this week. People are losing their jobs. People are losing their homes. People have lost their savings. You know, we get emails from folks who have worked their entire lives hoping to have a decent and secure retirement, and that's not going to happen. People are wondering what kind of life is going to be available for their kids, and I think it's just a terrible thought that I think a majority of Americans have now reached the conclusion that their kids will have a lower standard of living than they do, which is a reverse of the thing. So in the midst of all of that, how do we turn that around? How do we right now prevent this increasingly deep recession from becoming a depression? How do we understand how we got here in the first place and create an economy that works well for the middle class and not just for the people on top, which has certainly been the case for many, many years? Here in California, I've been hearing a lot of discussion about health care and the need for a national health care program, which I certainly believe in. We are the only country in the industrialized world without a national health care program. We spend far more per capita on health care than do the people of any other nation. And I think the people are ready right now for a national health care program, understanding it's not only that to dealing with 46 million Americans without health insurance, it's an economic issue. It is small businesses now that can't afford to provide health insurance for their workers or for the owners of a small business. It's General Motors that puts per automobile more money into health care than into steel. And that's just not a sustainable economic situation. So we got to get a handle on that, provide health care to all people. And I'm happy that in the last stimulus package, we managed to get some substantial funding for health care, which I happen to believe is one of the major problems within our deteriorating health care system, making sure that people have access to doctors, access to nurses, access to dentists. And we've made a major step forward, I think, in doing that by a $2 billion increase in community health centers, tripling the amount of money going to the National Health Service Corps, which means that we'll be able to forgive debts for doctors and nurses and dentists and get them into underserved areas. It's a pretty big deal. So we're making a little bit of progress there. We've got to deal with this whole Wall Street fiasco in a very deep sense. What we have seen is a small number of people, perhaps a few hundred people, with incredible wealth who have gambled with the future of America. They were not content making 20 or 30% rates of return. They needed even more. They were not content with making $50 million a year. They needed to make hundreds of millions of dollars a year. We have to deal with that. And we have to go back not to where we were a year ago. That's not good enough. We have to get rid of this whole crew of Wall Street tycoons who have got us to where we are. We need, in my view, a very deep investigation as to whether or not there were illegal activities taking place at the very top. Did these guys know that they were selling worthless paper? And if they did, they're going to have to pay for that. And we will see if our criminal justice system is capable of taking on some of the wealthiest and most powerful people in this country. And we need to bring people in whose goal is not simply in Wall Street making hundreds of millions a year, but getting credit out to the business community to create decent paying jobs, not to be ripping off the American people with 29% interest rates on credit cards, not to be tricking people who can't afford it into adjustable mortgages so that they lose their homes, et cetera, et cetera. But that whole issue of Wall Street is one we're really going to have to delve into. The difficulty of an investigation, to be very honest with you, is not only that we're taking on very powerful people, you're taking on both political parties there. Because while it was primarily the Republican Party, you know, the Alan Greenspans, the Phil Grahams, the George Bushes who deregulated everything, there are Democrats who were involved in that as well. So we're going to have to take a look at that. And I think to understand where we are today in terms of an economy, we have to take a hard look at the global economy. And understand that the global economy is a good thing, but it's got to be made to work for working families in this country and lower-income people all over the world, and not just for the heads of large corporations who want to throw American workers out on the street, move abroad, hire cheap labor, and bring those products back into this country. It's not just for the CEOs who want to manipulate guest worker programs, the H-1B, the H-2B program, to bring in low-wage labor from abroad to lower wages in this country. So my point here, Tom, is that in the midst of this economic crisis, obviously the first thing that we have to do is turn the economy around. But we have to go beyond that and understand that where we were a couple of years ago was not good either, that the middle class for many years has been shrinking, poverty has been increasing, people are losing their pensions, their health insurance. We need to radically rethink the way we do economics in this country so that we have a vibrant middle class and not just a growing differentiation between the people on top and everybody else.
Bernie, we have just a minute here before the break. There are a lot of people who are suggesting that this is one of those moments in time when we can really fundamentally change the system as opposed to simply shore up the pieces of it that seem to be sagging. Your thoughts?
I agree with that. And so, I think right now, I mean, I suspect that President Obama is wrestling with this issue every single moment. I think this is what we call a big change moment. You just can't patch it up anymore. I think what we have seen in recent years are problems so deep, so profound, so unfair, that we really need to have a fundamental rethinking of the nature of economics in America, because the current situation certainly has not worked well for ordinary people.
Yeah, it absolutely. And our banking system seems to be a mess. The way stock trading system.
All of the incentives in there are exactly the wrong incentives.
Exactly. Exactly. That is the key to the whole thing. It's Brunch with Bernie. Senator Bernie Sanders with us live from the West Coast today. And he'll be taking your calls right after the break. TomHartmann.com, by the way, for our live free chat room if you want to drop in.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program.
Plan 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartmann here with you, the place where progressives come to party. The Tom Hartmann radio program and our favorite hour of the week, Brunch with Bernie. Senator Bernie Sanders, our national town hall. He is taking your questions and answering them on the air. Bernie, ready to go?
Let's do it.
Okay, Bill in Los Angeles, in fact, where Bernie is today, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Bill, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Well, hi, Senator. I wanted to talk to you just for a minute about this bank bailout, because it seems like we're framing the argument wrong. We keep talking about whether we should nationalize or not nationalize, and of course we should have done that long ago, but what we really should be talking about is ownership. We've paid two or three times what these banks are worth, like Bank of America or Citicorp. We've given them free money, and we don't own anything. That's kind of a new kind of capitalism. It should be called chump capitalism, and the American public are the chumps. The other thing I wanted to point out, by not owning them, they're not really lowering the interest rates. We keep talking about loosening up the credit, but we don't have the interest rates we should have on a 30-year mortgage. It's always been tied to the 10-year Treasury note, which is at about 2.7 right now. So 30-year mortgage rates should really be down in the fours. But the banks aren't passing on all this free money they're getting, both from the Fed and from the government, and they're still keeping interest rates up in the mid-fives. So,
Bill, I think you're touching on a very, very important issue. And here's the issue. Against my votes, I should say, but my colleagues voted $700 billion for a bailout of Wall Street out of the Treasury, out of the taxpayers' pockets. In addition to that, as I'm sure Bill knows, we have – the Fed has provided about $2.2 trillion in loans to the financial industry and, we believe, other corporations. This is an unbelievable and staggering sum of money. And I think the question that Bill is asking, which is exactly the question that all of us have got to ask, okay, we've provided all of this money. What are we getting in return? What's new here in the game? What kind of interest rates are the American consumers going to be get? Homeowners are going to be get? Those of us with credit cards, are we going to be paying 29% from banks that we have bailed out? That's absurd. So I think, as I mentioned earlier, I think we need to do some fundamental rethinking about our relationship to Wall Street now that we have poured huge sums of money into it. I think President Obama has been doing many very good things in his first month in office. I think the stimulus package is an important step forward in protecting the middle class of this country. I am not, I have to say, overly impressed by what he is doing on Wall Street right now, and I think we need to be rethinking that. I voted against Tim Geithner for Secretary of Treasury because I think Mr. Geithner brings into that office many of the old think, many of the ways of framing issues that got us into this problem in the first place. So I think Bill makes a very important point that's on many of our minds right now as we head back to Washington next week.
James in New Paltz, New York. You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Gentlemen, greetings. To piggyback on the last question, Senator Sanders, my wife and I for years have used this. Can I mention a name, Tom? Is that okay? It's a particular credit card company.
Yeah.
Okay. It's a Capital One card. For years, we had around 6%. We get a notice in the mail recently that any new purchases, the interest rate now goes up to 30%.
Are you serious? From 7 to 30?
I can fax you or fax Tom or whoever.
I believe you.
Okay. Now, the thing is, they're able to circumvent New York state law because the usury law in New York is 15%. So I guess they must be located in another state.
Exactly. That's where they are, James.
Yes. So I have two questions. Number one, I believe Capital One was a recipient of federal money. I believe they were. I'm not sure. So why are they charging us enormous rates to meet the taxpayer on money that I basically helped provide to them? And number two, why can't we have national usury standards?
All right, James, you've asked an excellent, excellent question, and thank you for that question. And I agree with you on both instances. We are going to be introducing, my poor staff is working very hard. I'm sure they're cringing when they hear me say this, but we are going to be introducing national usury rate legislation. What James correctly understands is that what has happened is as a result of a Supreme Court decision, many of the credit card companies went out to, I think, South Dakota or someplace, where they were able to charge any rates they want nationally. That was the way they circumvented usury law, state usury law. We need new national usury law, which prohibits companies from charging 25-30%, these outrageous rates. We're going to do that. And James's other point is, isn't there something a little bit absurd when taxpayers are bailing out these companies and being forced to pay outrageously high credit card interest rates? And the answer is absolutely as well. So these are issues that have got to be dealt with as we deal with Wall Street right now. And James is right, in my view, on both counts.
Bernie, in the 10 seconds before we hit the break here, do you know of anybody in Congress who's serious about doing this besides yourself?
I think there are. We will see. But, I mean, let me tell you, the Wall Street folks and the financial interests will go off the wall on this one. Of course, they'll go nuts. But it's something that's long overdue. They're ripping off the American people right and left, and we've got to deal with it.
Yeah, and they're big donors to both parties. It's going to be a tough one. It's going to be a battle.
Yes, it will.
Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us. I think of him as America's senator. He's neither a Democrat nor an independent. A Democrat or Republican. He's the independent from Vermont. Sanders.Senate.gov is his website if you'd like to check out what's going on and sign up for his regular newsletter.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
The hour. Our program brought to you in part by the Teamsters, proud supporters of the Employee Free Choice Act, Teamster.org, their website. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour, Senator Bernie Sanders. He's got a regular newsletter, email newsletter that you can receive. You can sign up for it over at Sanders.Senate.gov. Always some interesting stuff in there, well worth checking out. And Bernie, back to the phones here.
Let's do it.
Sean in Vancouver, Washington. You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Senator Sanders, your old nemesis, Alan Greenspan, was on CNBC's special program called House of Cards, and he was making the point that we can't legislate away human greed, and that taking on balance free market capitalism is the best system that's ever been because it's lifted hundreds of millions of people out of poverty. As far as I'm concerned, that's an old canard. I wanted your opinion on whether or not we're ever going to get past that. I mean, it seems like, take for example, China. China is going through the same old model of economic development, and you know, with these coal power plants, and they're dumping mercury into the oceans. It's like some people just don't get it. I mean, are we supposed to raise our children to basically, in a premeditated fashion, take the American taxpayer hostage and extort the taxpayer because we're too big to fail? I just want to get your thoughts.
Thank you, Sean. Alan Greenspan is my old nemesis. When I was on the House Financial Services Committee, some of the listeners may remember that every 6 months or every year when Greenspan came before the committee, he and I would have a little bit of a discussion about where America should be going and the role of Wall Street, et cetera, et cetera. I disagree with Greenspan very fundamentally. I think the future of this country is going to rest in what I would call a mixed economy. We want to harness the energy and the innovativeness of entrepreneurs to create new products, new wealth. I believe in that very strongly. But on the other hand, I think we should be learning from our friends in Norway, Sweden, Finland, Denmark, that the government can play a very important role in making sure that all of our people have health care, that our kids have wonderful starts in life with good education, good child care, that workers are treated with dignity and can have time off. In Finland, for example, workers have 30 days off paid vacation, that when you reach your retirement age, you have security and a decent retirement benefit, that in fact you can create a strong safety net so that all people have at least a minimum and dignified standard of living, and that you don't live in a cowboy capitalist society where greed is the golden ring out there and some people can make billions while 18% of our kids live in poverty. Tens of millions of workers are falling further and further behind, where everybody is kind of banging their heads against the wall. We can do better than that. So I think we do want to harness the entrepreneurial spirit, but also the role of government is to make sure that all of our people have a certain level of security. I think we are seeing that in existence and have for many years in countries in Scandinavia and elsewhere. So on that issue, of course, Greenspan and I have fundamental differences of opinion.
Gina in Fort Lauderdale, listening on WINS. You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hi. I had a question for you about the what you're doing for people on the mortgage situation. I don't believe that I'm in a position to be helped by what's happening, what Obama's doing with the package. I think it's mostly for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac people. I think my only hope is to have the bankruptcy laws change so that judges can renegotiate a mortgage. Do you see that happening at all?
Gina, that's a very good point. I voted against the bankruptcy bill that was passed several years ago. I think it was a disastrous bill for working families. And to answer your question, I think that more and more members of Congress are beginning to understand that and want to take a new look at that legislation.
JR in Washington, you're on with Bernie Sanders.
Morning. My question kind of follows up the last caller. I didn't lose my home due to adjustable rates. I lost my home based on the loss of income because of the economic downturn, especially in the commercial building sector. And what I'm wondering is there any kind of proposal or even, you know, a conversation about how people like me can get back into our homes, you know, or into a home within less than the 7 year period that it's going to require for us to get beyond this bad credit situation?
And to add to that, Bernie, I think the last number I saw was 1 in 9 homes right now is empty in America.
Well, I think, Joe, when we have, if Tom is right, 1 in 9 homes are empty, that sounds like a very high number to me, Tom.
Yeah.
But clearly, as people get foreclosed and have, and we have empty homes, we have a housing market which is declining. The value of housing is dropping like a rock, and you have people in distress. Clearly, we have the mix here to try to create something to put people back in homes at rents or mortgages that they can afford. So, JR, I would say there is a lot of conversation on that, and you're going to hear, I think, in the next few weeks, a lot more about that.
Peter in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, listening on Sirius Satellite Radio. You're on with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hello, Senator Sanders. Hello, Tom. It's an honor for me to get to chat with you today. I'll be as brief as I can. And I really want to ask Senator Sanders why some seemingly simple solutions haven't been applied. And I know, Tom, you addressed them with the amount of money, for example, given to companies in the banking bailout. You could have formed, say, something simple like a model like Freddie Mac initially served, or Fannie Mae, excuse me, where a low-interest mortgage lender started and essentially run by the government, kept the whole mortgage industry in check and didn't let greed run rampant. And if you could do something similar with a, you know, government-run banking system, government-run health care, wouldn't that keep greed in check?
Well, you know, Pete, I think you're making the same point that a caller made earlier in the program, and that is if we're putting many, many hundreds of billions of dollars into Wall Street, do we not have the right to demand fundamental changes in the way they do business, or in fact can we do it in another way directly through the government? And I think that point is exactly right. I voted against both bailouts. I voted against Mr. Geithner to be Secretary of Treasury because I don't want to continue seeing us go the same old way. There need to be fundamental changes in Wall Street now that we have poured so much money into it. We have to make credit available to small business, to working people, in a new way, in an affordable way. The goal cannot simply be to have people on Wall Street becoming incredibly rich and strangling the American economy. So the answer to your question is yes, I think that's exactly the direction we've got to go.
Randy in Seattle, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, I have a question about the changing use of the filibuster in the Senate. I remember when I was younger, it was a protection against the tyranny of the majority, but for someone to exercise that, a senator to exercise it, you would see him, and in those days it was only a he, a senator, reading the telephone book or doing something that would bring the public view to how the filibuster was used, and it was used judiciously. And it seems like what the Senate has done now is simply turned that around and said, we're a body that requires a 60% majority on all votes, and we can take a quick straw poll, and if we don't have it, we won't even put the feet to the fire of the Republican minority that wants to filibuster. We'll just fold up our tent and move on. Why has it changed?
Well, Randy, I don't think that is – well, let me back up a little bit here. What we saw in the previous session of Congress, the 110th, is an unprecedented use of the filibuster on the part of the Republican Party. If my memory is correct, they had some 95 filibusters, which certainly included almost every important piece of legislation, meaning that you have to get 60 votes. And at that point, we were unable to do that. I do believe, Randy, that what you're going to see now with 58 Democrats, 56 plus Lieberman and myself equals 58, we think Al Franken will shortly be joining us. I think you're going to see just what you want to see. And I think you're going to see the majority leader, Harry Reid, saying to the Republicans, if you want a filibuster, well, you're going to be here on a Saturday, and you're going to be here on a Sunday, and you're going to be here 24 hours a day because we are going to pass the legislation that the American people want. The problem that Reid had in the last couple of years is, A, we didn't have the votes, really. And second of all, there is so much legislation that has to be passed that in some cases you can't spend 3 weeks staying on the same piece. But I think you're going to see a new tune. We've already seen it. Believe me, I've already been in Washington for several weekends right now precisely on that. And I think you will see more of that.
Ann in Eugene, Oregon. We have about a minute left here before the break, Ann. You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Okay, I'll make this quick. In a finite planet that we live on, how can we be dependent on an economy that depends on growth when we, and in that case, we can never be a sustainable society? Is anybody thinking about that?
Well, Ann, sure we are. Let me tell you, the stimulus package that was just signed by the president the other day has more money, far more money, going into the creation of sustainable energies, wind, solar, biomass, geothermal, and others, more money going into weatherization and to energy efficiency than this country has ever seen before. So many of us are aware that because of global warming, because of pollution in general, that we need to make this country and this planet far more sustainable than it is.
It's our brunch with Bernie. Very well said, Bernie. Thank you. It's our brunch with Bernie. Our Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us. America's senator, in my humble opinion. And he is answering your questions at 866-303-2270. TomHartmann.com if you want to drop into our free live chat room, AirAmerica.com for a free video stream. We'll be right back.
Visit HartmannRadio.com for live streaming video of the Tom Hartmann Program.
Welcome back to the place where despair is not an option. Get out there and get active. It's the Tom Hartmann Radio Program. Bernie, I just found this article from a week or so ago in USA Today. It was the one I was referring to, just as an FYI. I don't know if the guy has his numbers right or not, but this is a news story from USA Today. The headline, No One Home, 1 in 9 housing units vacant. And it says a record 1 in 9 U.S. homes are vacant, a glut created by the housing boom and subsequent collapse. The numbers are further documentation of the gravity of the housing problem, says Nicholas Ritsinas, head of Harvard University's Joint Center for Housing Studies. This inventory is delaying any kind of housing recovery.
That's an unbelievable number.
Yeah, but do you look at some of the neighborhoods around here, around the country, it's downright spooky. Anyhow, back to the phone calls. Here, Jerry, is it Jerry or Gary in Miramar, Florida? It's Jerry.
It's Jerry.
Hey, Jerry.
Hi, thank you, Senator Saunders. Thank you for the show. I was laid off. 4 months it took me to get my unemployment. No one answers the phone. You get no response on the website. In order to remain solvent, I had to cash in my 401k, which had already lost 40-50% of its worth. Now I'm being taxed 20-30% on it. To make matters worse, my car lender which is a bank that we gave money to, won't even renegotiate my car note. I mean, the interest rate. So, I got three things here. We have to do a better job on unemployment insurance. I shouldn't have to wait 4 months to get a check. Number two, why am I being doubly taxed, having to pull out the money from the IRA when, I didn't want to do it, but the state held me up. And Florida has the lowest, one of the lowest rates in the country, $275 a week.
All right, Jerry, you raise a lot of very good issues. I'm hearing this not only from Florida, but I'm hearing this from other states as well. What's going on is states are running huge deficits. They're cutting back on their personnel, and they don't have the capabilities of administering their programs. What we're trying to do in Washington, what we have done, is extended unemployment benefits, especially for higher unemployment areas. It's a little bit absurd for us to be putting more money into the program if workers who are losing their jobs can't get it because the states don't have the resources to hire the personnel to administer the program. My hope is that from the stimulus package, we're pouring many billions of dollars into the states to help them, and I certainly hope, and I thank you for reminding me, that we make sure that there are personnel in the unemployment offices to make sure that people get the checks that we're providing for. In terms of the interest rates, it's the same old story. This is an issue that we have to deal with, and the IRA is the same story. Desperate people are now being hurt because they have to go into the IRA and they're paying taxes on that. That also makes no sense. So the questions that Jerry is raising are absolutely right.
Philip in Boca Raton, Florida. You're on with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hello?
Philip, you're on the air.
Oh, yeah, thank you. Thank you for taking my call. I have two questions, and I'll take the answers off to you. I know you got a lot of people waiting. First thing I'll comment is I'm kind of very displeased with Obama's bill on housing because I think it's going to have the contrary effect. For example, if you were a lender and suddenly someone came along and changed the terms of the loan, I would have great reluctance to lend in the future. And if I did, then I certainly would demand a very high risk premium. The second question is OPEC is the monopoly on petroleum. When the price was $140 a barrel, Bush bought oil for the strategic reserve. Now the price of crude is about $39 a barrel. Why don't we just load up? And if they raise the price, we'll dump crude on the market. Thank you very much.
In terms of the petroleum reserve, I think we are pretty close to capacity right now. I don't know how much more we could absorb. In terms of housing, Philip, these are extraordinary times. And I think there are no simple or 100% right answers to the problem. The fact of the matter is that people are losing their homes. They are in danger of losing their homes. And we have got to protect those people and protect the housing market as well. Tom indicated that 1 in 9 homes in America are unoccupied, which is just an unbelievable number. We can't allow, in my view, even more homes to go unoccupied. So the solutions may not be perfect, but I think the immediate task at hand is to make sure that millions of Americans are not thrown out of their homes.
David in Federal Way, Washington, you're on with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Did you say David?
Yes, I did. You're on the air.
All righty. Hi. I'll try to make this quick and wait for your response offhand. I kind of think lying out there is a big issue. And I know you've been talking about all those right-wing shows like Rush Limbaugh and all that. I think maybe we should create, if it's at all possible, an organization that will employ thousands of people in dealing with exposing and bringing out the truth, because I think the truth really destroys a lot of For instance, when McCain and Palin were running their campaign, I thought it was one of the most despicable things I'd ever seen. I couldn't believe that it could be legal to do that, especially when there were people in the audience screaming that Obama was a terrorist and kill him and stuff like that.
Well, David, I think the answer, I don't think you could have an institute of truth because people will always disagree as to what that is, of course. But what I do believe, getting back to the first point that we discussed in this campaign, is that we need more voices out there who are speaking for the needs of working families and lower-income people rather than who are mouthpieces for the wealthy and corporate America, which takes us back to the whole issue of corporate ownership of media in America and how we get diverse voices out there and why the work that Tom Hartman and other people are doing is so very important.
Yeah. And all these think tanks, I mean, it's amazing the amount of mind-boggling wealth that has been channeled into, you know, Heritage Foundation and Cato Institute and all these other right-wing think tanks, Competitive Enterprise Institute and whatnot. We're seeing a few efforts to push back on that on the left, but it's just like it's almost some days you say,
well, look, these people who have money, the people who have money are not dumb. I mean, they are not dumb. And what they do is hire a lot of intellectuals to mouth their perspectives, and that's what these think tanks are about.
Right, to maintain and protect their own cash. Senator Bernie Sanders, our guest, and our Brunch with Bernie Hour wrapping up right now. You can check out his website. I strongly encourage you to. It's just great. Sanders.senate.gov. Sign up for his weekly newsletter or his regular newsletter. Bernie, thanks so much for being with us.
Good to be with you, Tom. Thank you.
Always great talking with you. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Thanks for listening to the AM 620 KPOJ podcast, sponsored by the Better World Club, providing travel services, auto insurance, and 24/7 nationwide roadside assistance, but not part of the highway lobby. This is Tom Hartman, Better World Club member since first moving to Oregon. Check out their eco benefits like the nation's only bicycle roadside assistance and their e-newsletter, Kicking Asphalt, at betterworldclub.com.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the second hour of our program. Anything Goes Friday here. Let me just toss a few things out real quickly. First of all, China. With cash to spend, China starts investing globally. This from the New York Times. And I guess time for our China alert. This is really an amazing story. China's total investments this month, $41 billion. And that's not in China. They're going out and they're buying up the rest of the planet. They are also spending $800 billion in China on light rail, high-speed internet, high-speed infrastructure. We're spending $40 billion on rail and light rail and transportation projects in our so-called stimulus. They're spending $800 billion internally. And then outside the country, $41 billion just so far this month. And the month's not even over. Where are they getting all that money? Well, from us! This is the insanity of our trade policies, just the bottom line insanity of our trade policies. Number two, the case for a truth commission, Patrick Leahy. We'll get into this a little more next week, I suppose. But Pat Leahy is saying, you know, we need to get to the bottom of this. And getting to the bottom of it is frankly, more important than putting people in jail. If I am summarizing Mr. Leahy's sentiments accurately, and he may dispute that, I'm not sure, but seems to be the case. And here's another one. Mileage tax considered by Obama Transportation Secretary LaHood. So this is what happens when you put a Republican in your cabinet. We had a conversation about that here in the state of Oregon. What if we went from a gas tax to a mileage tax? Well, what that does is it penalizes people who have fuel-efficient vehicles. And by the way, the fuel-efficient vehicles tend to be fuel-efficient because they're lighter, which means that they're producing less wear and tear on the roads, which means that they cost the state less. So I think that we need to stay with the gasoline tax. We should simply, the big mistakes that we made with the gas tax back 40, 50 years ago was making it a fixed amount of money rather than making it a percentage of the cost of gasoline, like it is in most countries around the world. So, you know, let's go back to a carbon tax. Fact of the matter is, a gallon of gas actually costs $10 in the United States when you figure the cost of all the cancers that are produced, the cost of the environment, the cost of the military that is necessary to defend getting that oil out of those regions around the world where they would really rather not have us and our oil companies and to the United States, et cetera, and all the subsidies and everything else. It's crazy. Finally, spam. I'm just curious about your suggestions or thoughts or experiences on this. And in fact, we're going to give away an autographed copy of my book, Walking Your Blues Away, at, where'd it go? Here it is. Walking Your Blues Away, for the camera. And to whoever has the best suggestion, I get in a mind-boggling amount of spam, as you can imagine. My email address, tom@tomhartmann.com, has been public and on my website for, you know, the better part of 10 years, or maybe longer. I don't know. I was running forums for CompuServe back in the 80s. I remember when they rolled out HTML at a big meeting down in Columbus, Ohio, and we were all sitting there going, that'll never fly. So, you know, I've been around this thing for a long time. And my email address has been out there for a long time, ever since domain names first became available and I was able to get tomhartmann.com. And so I've developed all these ways to filter spam. For example, if somebody sends an email to me that has, you know, more than five or six recipients in the email address, it automatically goes in my junk filter. If somebody sends more than two emails a day to me, they automatically get put on the twit filter, and I just never see emails from them again. Now, one of the things that's really slick that I've noticed that is making me crazy is, you know, you get these emails from organizations, and I get a lot of them from, like, progressive organizations, people who would be natural constituencies saying, oh, let us tell you about what's going on, you know, or book publishers or whatever. And down at the bottom it says, if you don't want to be on this list, click here. And so, you know, I started about 4 or 5 months ago saying, okay, what the hell, I'm going to try it. And I would click there because I was just getting a couple of them to unsubscribe from this. So you are now unsubscribed from this list. And then, you know, 2 days later, I'm getting three. Not from that organization. They have actually unsubscribed me. But now three other organizations have my email address. It's like these companies are reselling email addresses of people who have unsubscribed, because by unsubscribing, you're proving that this is a real email address. So now I've had to recalibrate my spam filter to say it actually has the ability to read the entire content of any email. And so any email that has the word safe unsubscribe as one word, which is one of the companies that does this, if it's a safe unsubscribe in the email, it automatically goes to junk and I never even see it. And I am never again going to click on those things. And so anyhow, I'm wondering, you know, what your experiences are. I know our lines are totally full right now, so the first few callers will not have solutions to spam. But, you know, what do you do? How do you solve those problems? So there's a bunch of stuff, the news of the day. And, of course, the stock market is in the tank. Gold is pushing 1,000. I've been saying, you know, 4 years ago, Those of you who are regular listeners to the program know at least 4 years ago, I was saying, and people were telling me I was absolutely crazy. What? We got good times. Look at this. You know, housing prices are going through the roof, blah, blah, blah. And I was saying, you know, pay off your debt. Get ready. Hang on. It's coming. You're going to see the Dow at 5,000, and you're going to see gold well over 1,000. In fact, I think it's going to be well over 1,500. And this is not investment advice, by the way. This is what I've been saying for years. And in fact, Louise and I put a good chunk of our savings into gold when it was $290 an ounce. And everybody was telling us we were crazy when we lived in Vermont. And so I see this trend continuing. And as I said, I don't think it's going to turn around. I don't think we're going to see the Dow come back up until the P.E. ratio is in single digits. The price-to-earnings ratio across the board, on in the Dow at least, is in single digits. And right now I think it's around 13-14% on average. So there's still downward space to go, just my opinion. And I don't put myself out as any kind of investment expert on this. You know, please know. This is just, one observer. So anyhow, a lot going on. 866-303-2270, your telephone number. Frank in L.A. Hey, Frank, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, Tom, I wanted to talk to the senator. However, if you get a chance to talk to him, eventually, during the week or whatever, why don't you tell him to introduce some legislation to prevent the privatizing of the government, because it's costing the taxpayers 10 to 50% more money than if the government did it itself, and that's just wasted money.
I'm not an economist, but...
When you spend money to pay off a huge debt, that's wasted money that could go to pay for the infrastructure.
Yeah. No, Frank, you're absolutely right. And this is something that Bernie has railed on. And by the way, if you're on hold because you wanted to talk to Bernie Sanders, hang up now. He's not here. No offense, but, if you got a question for Bernie, call on Fridays and put it to him. As to my thoughts on that, yes, you know my positions well on this. The government should be the custodian of our commons. And in my opinion, it is a crime against democracy to have functions which should be done by people who are employed by we the people collectively, instead done by private companies. So when they take the concessions at Yellowstone, as happened under the Reagan administration, one of the early privatizations, and say, okay, let's hand this off to a company owned by Pepsi-Cola, as I recall, that is, in my opinion, a crime against democracy. And they say, well, it's more efficient, and really the bottom line is you're using our commons to make money for somebody. And our commons should not be here to make money. We shouldn't be privatizing our schools. We shouldn't be privatizing our police departments. We shouldn't be privatizing our fire departments. I know some communities are privatizing functions of things like, fixing potholes and road repair and things. None of that stuff. Frankly, I think that all of those should be done by we the people and accountable to we the people. Why do we have to have some guy in the middle skimming 10% off the top or 15 or 20% off the top after you pay the multimillion-dollar CEO salaries and the 10% dividends to the stockholders? Why do you have to have that in the middle? It just doesn't make any sense to me, frankly. So, Jan in Kent, Washington. Hey, Jan, got a minute to the break. What's up?
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to ask, why isn't it better publicized that Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and the Federal Reserve are not owned by the federal government but are privately owned? Who owns them? And please don't say a banking cartel. Can you give names?
Sure. The Federal Reserve is owned.
Shouldn't their names be changed to have federal taken out, which is purposely misleading to the American taxpayer?
Yeah,
so
I
that
agree.
We know who they are, who we are really bailing out?
Yes. Fannie and Freddie, originally when they were started, were federal corporations, and they were privatized, I believe, during the Clinton administration. Their stock was sold in the open market. They should be bought back, and they should be made, in fact, Fannie, I think, was created as part of the New Deal. With regard to the Fed is owned by its 12 member banks, and those 12 banks are owned by their member banks. So I remember when I lived in Vermont, our bank was the Chittenden Bank, and that bank was one of the stockholders of the First Federal Bank of Boston, which is one of the 12 federal, either 10 or 12 federal banks. And so if I bought stock in the Chittenden Bank, I was indirectly buying stock in the Federal Reserve. That's how the Fed is owned. And you're right. They are not federal agencies, and they shouldn't be called that. And more people need to know about it.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
In olden days, a glimpse of stocking was looked on as something shocking. Now heaven knows, anything goes.
Anything goes Friday. You pick the topic, we'll talk about it. Although I do have to tell you about this. Fellow by the name of aeronautical engineer by the name of Bernie Bamford was browsing through the Google Ocean. Google is now mapping the ocean. And he saw off the coast of Morocco what he said looks like an aerial map of Milton Keynes. Or is it Keynes? It's where Sue lives, Sue Nethercutt, who runs our chat room. And it's... which is a city in the UK, by the way, and it's square and it's got lines and it's I'm looking at the picture here in the sun. It's a perfect rectangle the size of whales laying on the bed of the Atlantic Ocean 3.5 miles down, host of crisscrossing lines looking like the map of a vast metropolis enclosed by a boundary. So they think they may have found Atlantis. And what's interesting to me about this is that off the coast of Morocco, if the people from that place, let's say it was an island at one time that sank in some sort of volcanic event or whatever, if the people from that place headed, instead of due east, if they headed northeast, they would have ended up on the coast of Spain. And the Basque people, you know, ETA, the Basque separatist group, the Basque people speak a language, Basque, B-A-S-Q-U-E. They speak a language that has no known European root. It's the only language in all of Europe that can't be traced back to either the Norse languages or to Sanskrit, which is the root of everything else, the Romance languages and everything else. It can't be traced back to any of the Asian languages. It can't be traced back to any of the Native American languages. Very strange. So maybe they have found it. And by the way, the Basques, who are constantly fighting the Spanish, saying we want our own country because we are our own people. We are a new, unique group. The Basques... legend is that they are the survivors of the lost island of Atlantis. And, you know, the guy who first wrote about this was Plato, by the way, 3,000 years ago. And he hypothesized that the location, based on the folklore from the Basques and from others, was in the neighborhood of where Google mapping the ocean has found it. So, very strange stuff. Ron in Essex, Vermont. Hey, Ron, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, Tom, I just wanted, you know, I hear everybody talking about filibustering,
mm-hmm.
but I never heard of anyone say, how does a filibuster end?
It ends in two ways.
One way or the other.
Yeah, there's two ways that a filibuster ends. A filibuster, the way the Senate rules work is that somebody proposes a piece of legislation, and then there's debate about it. And if that debate goes on and on and on and on without end, the Senate will call a vote to end, in other words, to end the debate, to shut up whoever's talking about it. And that's called a cloture vote, as in kind of closing the debate. And if that cloture vote can't get 60 votes, then the debate continues. And so, and the debate continues until one of two things happens. Either those who want to end the debate, that is, end the filibuster, see, filibustering, you know, maintaining the debate or the discussion ad infinitum is the definition of a filibuster, I guess, broadly speaking. Either the side that wants to end it gets 60 votes, or, as happened a couple of times back in the Civil Rights era when you had Strom Thurmond and you know, others of his ilk out there filibustering things like the Civil Rights legislation, they would simply talk for 2 or 3 days and take turns at it and read the Bible and read the telephone book and whatnot until public opinion got so strong against what they were doing, or they felt that they had made their point, that they just said, okay, that's it. We are going to end our obstruction here and then the debate would end and there didn't have to be a cloture vote, or there would be a cloture vote and they wouldn't vote and it would close. Make sense?
I see. Okay. All right, thanks.
Thanks a lot. See, the problem is that Harry Reid has, the way that it has worked over the last couple of years is that the Republicans, instead of actually, you know, they say, we're going to filibuster this thing. We're going to, you know, we're going to force a debate. And Harry Reid, instead of saying, fine, there's the floor, start talking. And, you know, as I said, Strom Thurmond, I think he was the guy who had the all-time record. He had, you know, stood there for hours. You know, it's probably over in Guinness or on Wikipedia. somebody will have the actual numbers, but it was mind-boggling. You know, they would just stand there and talk for hour after hour after hour and bring in the cots because it has to go 24 hours a day. Because once they stop, it has stopped, and, you know, the other side wins. So they had the, and the problem is that, you know, the Republicans say to Harry Reid, we're gonna filibuster this, and he says, okay, I withdraw the legislation, and thus withdraw the debate. Mario in Los Angeles. Hey, Mario.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. I'd like to make a couple of historical points about the monkey cartoon symbolization.
In the New York Post.
During the, sir?
In the New York Post.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
During the slavery period here in America, there existed the three-fifths law to justify the enslavement of Africans in America by saying that the slavery of humans is wrong. However, since Africans are three-fifths human and two-fifths ape, then technically they're not fully human, which enables them by law to be enslaved. And during World War II, right after in France, during a great many of the French ladies were told by the American GIs that blacks have tails because they're part ape. And I was told this by a black GI who was in France right after World War II, and that's what the French ladies were telling him. Hmm. Now, as a Vietnam veteran era veteran, I know that when you reduce an enemy to a subhuman level, you make him more easily able to be killed, like in Vietnam, the Goop,
sure.
Iraq, the Hajis, and yeah. Down south. They refer to, you know, the former African slaves as niggers. And one of the definitions of the word nigger is a beast of burden like an ox or a mule. And I think that the people of the Daily Post saw the shooting of the chimp in Connecticut as a golden opportunity from God to say that what they...
Mario, I'm sorry we're out of time, but your point is well taken. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
We have a couple of folks who posted suggestions over at TomHartman.com on our message board how to deal with spam. One is enlist the assistance of the robot pigeons. Yes, a fine suggestion. Another one is, this is confirming what I thought I was seeing happening. Unfortunately, what you ran into with the unsubscribe is a common occurrence. Also, if you reply, either asking to be removed or in any way whatsoever, again, you have verified your email address, and it'll be sold as a hot name. Not just a hot name, but an even more valuable one, one that elicits a reaction. Yeah. So, I don't know the solution, other than to, you know, filter for that word, but... we will, at the end of the day, Sean will be picking out the best suggestion that we get by telephone or on our blog over at TomHartman.com for how to deal with spam, because it's a problem that we all have. I love hearing from my listeners, and there's a lot of people that you know, and I read all the emails that I get that don't fall into the category. I mean, there's a small number of people who try to send me 20, 30 emails a day, and they just, you know, unfortunately, it's not possible for me to handle. But the occasional thoughtful email, I appreciate them. I don't usually answer them, but I appreciate them and I read them. But that's a whole different thing from spam. What are you pointing at? So anyhow, 866-303-2270 is our telephone number. And, oh, by the way, before I pick up your calls, I just wanted to make a comment on Mario dropping the N-word here in the last segment. I felt that the context, I let him continue with that, although we were up against the break, and it's a hard break at the bottom of the hour. I really thought his comments were well taken, that, you know, the history, although the three-fifths reference is actually, that, you know, that gets into a whole compromise that the states had. It wasn't any kind of biological thing. But nonetheless, that's the contemporary mythology. But the point is that the history of the portrayal of African Americans as primates is something that was really a big deal in the 19th and early 20th century. It's still, you know, that god-awful tradition carried on by the Ku Klux Klan and their ilk. And his referencing the racism, the racial stories that his father, an African-American soldier in France during World War II, encountered. And so, you know, when he started talking about the genesis of the N-word, I felt, given that it was he who was doing the speaking and the context in which it was common, I wasn't going to blow it up and bleep it. But that's the first time in the 7 years, as of next week, that we've been doing this show, that word has appeared on this show. Maybe I'm one of Eric Holder's cowards. You know, he said we're cowards when it comes to talking about race. And I think there's something to be said for that. And although we've had some fairly brutal conversations about race on this show over the years, I don't think that it's discussed enough. And perhaps even the reticence to use the language, to use language like that, is part of that cowardice. I'm not sure. I really need to consider this for a while. Obsidian in Raleigh, North Carolina. Hey, Obsidian, welcome to the show.
Greetings, Tom, to you and yours.
Thank you.
As far as the aspect of language is concerned, I've always had a problem with that, even if it's the English language, so enough about that.
Okay.
Well, go figure. Yeah. Anyway, originally what I was calling about was regarding the aspect of GMOs that you had a discussion about yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
One, to begin with, even though the biotech industries like Monsanto, Dow, Syngenta, and a couple of other ones have engaged in that and testing of that since the 1990s, which was considered science fiction at that time, really should not be done because even somebody tell me, say, well, nature does it all the time. And I said, you know, you're right, except for one thing. At least when nature does it, it's done over a period of time where things are done in a harmonious fashion and there's no side effects from it. However,
right.
When humans do it, you're talking about jamming a gene from one animal or from a human into a plant cell for a particular intention. And no regard to the after effects or whatever you want to call it or the outcome. And thus, if a human consumes that as part of their food and they end up with problems as a result, that just throws a whole monkey wrench into the physical system.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree. I have a lot of problems with genetically modified organisms. I think that, trans species or trans kingdom in this case,
mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, fish enzymes and squid DNA genes
right.
being put into plants, very, very problematic. And then, of course, that now they're talking about actually building a virus from scratch. And,
yeah.
you know,
well, the thing, Tom, you know, is that the only way most people can really avoid dealing with GMOs in their food every day is generally to go by way of organic.
Yep.
So that because generally if you're dealing with organic food stock, you don't have a problem with that crossing into it.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely
perfect.
Right, and it's one of the reasons that you know, Louise and I do an awful lot of our shopping looking for organic. It's nice, actually, the amount of organic food that is starting to show up in
right.
in the Safeway kind of stores. I mean, in the chain stores. But more often than not, we find ourselves in New Seasons or Whole Foods or one of those kind of stores.
There you go.
We have the downside of that is that, you know, we have enough of an income that we can afford to do that. And that's not true of many Americans.
Exactly.
And one of the reasons why we need to think of this as part of the commons, our food supply.
Yeah. Basically, as far as the food chain goes for everyday people that may not be able to afford it, it should be available so they can have a choice of whether they want organic or if they want actually GMOs in their food that's known to them so they can make their own conscious choice.
Yeah, and I'd be surprised if anybody said, yes, I want it. But who knows? I mean, maybe they do. Thank you, Obsidian. I appreciate the call and the thought that went into it. Michael in Los Angeles listening on K-Talk. Hey, Michael.
Hey, Tom. How are you?
Just great. What's up?
In my opinion, we have the most liberal Congress and White House in a generation. We have a majority of the country coming to terms with the failure of Friedman economics. And yet on this day, in the most liberal state in the country, California, the governor will sign the most conservative and draconian budget of any state, including the United States government, in my lifetime. I mean, aren't they listening? I mean, don't they know what
the Republicans are not? And if Michael, correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is that part of the deal that the Republican one or two or however many it was, Republican members of the assembly who crossed over to make the deal, part of what they extracted was that you will now have open primaries in California. Is that right?
That's right. And I mean, this is coming. The cuts are unfathomable as far as the public. You know, we have been, our social services safety net has been gutted and obsessed with being gutted over the last 20 years. We've closed more hospitals, health care clinics, and trauma centers than any other state in the country. And yet here comes the Sacramento legislature, so-called liberals, coming down the I-5 with their bulldozers ready to just push these people all out into the sea, apparently. I mean, where's the same criteria of fiscal restraint when it comes to the Pentagon, financial services, the salaries of elected officials, foreign aid, non-bid contracting? I mean, where's the same fiscal restraint and discipline? Why is it always the poor? Every single time, attacking the poor is not the final solution.
No, it's not. And this insanity goes back to when Reagan was first elected governor. It goes back to Prop 13. It goes back to a small group of very, very wealthy Californians who have been, largely since Reagan was governor, pulling the strings and singing the tune. And by the way, let me tell you about open primaries. I grew up in Lansing, Michigan. I grew up in Michigan where we have open primaries. And it was a sport. And my dad was real involved in Republican politics, and so I saw this from the inside. Michigan was the only state where the Democratic Party voted for George Wallace for president of the United States in the primary. And it wasn't because the Democrats voted for George Wallace. It was because the Republicans crossed over to vote in the Democratic primary to get George Wallace on the ticket because they wanted to make fools of the Democrats. And it wasn't the first time it happened. In fact, it happens with some regularity in Michigan. And what the Republicans will do, in fact, it happened, Jim Blanchard, the governor of Michigan, became the Republican, not the current governor, but this is back, 10 years ago or so, 15 years ago. He became governor because there was a strong Democrat, whose name I'm forgetting, who the Democratic Party was going to put up against him. And Jack Kevorkian's lawyer threw his hat into the ring, a well-known kind of Michigan crackpot character who was, he thought of himself as Ralph Nader, but he was a genuine crackpot. And so the Republicans all crossed over in the primary, and they voted for Kevorkian's lawyer in such large numbers in this open primary in Michigan that he was the guy who went on the final ballot up against Blanchard, the Republican. As I recall, it was Blanchard. I might be wrong on that, but I'm pretty sure it was. But it went up against the Republican, and of course he lost. I mean, even the Democrats wouldn't vote for him. And that's how Michigan got a Republican governor back before Jennifer Granholm. That's what happens with open primaries. That's why the Republicans said, okay, the pound of flesh that we want here in California is open primaries, because they will use that to destroy the Democratic Party in the state of California. And for that, your Republican governor and your Republican lawmakers have sold out your state. I'm telling you, Michael, it's a disaster. You're absolutely right. It is a disaster on steroids, no pun intended, on Arnold. We'll be right back.
Visit HartmanRadio.com for live streaming video of the Tom Hartman Program.
Don't you have egg, bacon, spam and sausage?
That's got spam in it.
Hasn't got as much spam in it as spam, egg, sausage and spam, has it?
Could you do the egg, bacon, spam and sausage without the spam then?
Yeah.
What do you mean, yeah? I don't like spam.
Yes, we don't like spam, thank you very much.
Indeed, enough already.
So, House Minority Whip Eric Cantor recently created a YouTube video called The House GOP Is Back. to the tune of Aerosmith's Back in the Saddle. You know the song, Back in the Saddle Again. It's actually, Aerosmith's version is different from the old country and western one that was one of the cowboys from the 1920s. Actually, it was a theme song, Gene Autry's theme song from the 20s or 30s. But in any case, Back in the Saddle. So my suggestion to Eric Cantor, if he really wants to use a Back in the Saddle Again theme, you know, it's a... For the House GOP, there's a perfect one out there. It was produced by the Firesign Theater back years ago, and they're on their album, I Think We're All Bozos on This Bus. Here it is.
Back from the shadows again.
Or at least they think they are.
Out where an engine's your friend. Where the vegetables are green and you can pee into the stream. Yes, we're back from the shadows again.
And then the little conversation. It sounds kind of like Republicans.
I'm the whispering squad.
And I'm the lonesome bee tick.
And I'm Artie Choke. And we're just a joke.
And don't be afraid, little people, because we're just holy ground.
Great.
Yeah, but what about you, partner? What you doing today?
Can't be much, lonesome. Nobody's working.
Nobody except us, and I'm getting tired of standing here with these geeks a-gawking at me.
Now you keep it sweet, Pete.
Listen here, Leafhead, I'm going to...
Now, boys. Fighting's out of style. Yeah. And fun's where the fair
is. Isn't this all like Republicans?
In the future, that is.
You can bet your roots towards it. Tons of fun.
And technical stimulation.
That's what I need.
And there's lots more of me where I come from.
In government-inflicted simulation.
The future can't wait. No place to hide.
Yeah, so climb on aboard.
We're going inside.
We're going back to the shadows again.
Yeah, that's where the Republicans need to go. Back to the shadows.
Out where an Indian's your friend.
Going down.
Where the vegetables are green, and you can pee right into the stream, and that's important. We're back from the shadows again.
So, my suggestion, Eric Cantor, here's the theme song for you, Firesign Theater, circa. I don't know when that album was cut, but it was during my youth. I remember it well. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Christine in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, Christine, what's up?
Hi. Well, there are 20 states that have passed a resolution declaring themselves sovereign and for the feds to stop infringing on the rights of the states, referring to the 10th Amendment, which states that the powers not specifically granted to the federal government reserved to the states and to the people.
Yeah, my understanding, Christine, is that none of these resolutions are binding and that these are basically statements made by far-right Republicans in most of the states.
Oh, I was just wondering why Oregon wasn't on board with the other 20 states that...
Because we don't have a far-right legislature. These are states who are saying things like, you know, or Republicans who are saying things like, you know, we don't need no stinking money for education and things like that. I mean, that's really what it is. It's the hyper-federalist movement. And, you know, very often these resolutions are sort of like, you know, Mother's Day resolutions. They get passed without anybody even seriously considering them because they absolutely are not binding. They're just statements of you know, whatever. So, Christine, I wouldn't give it a lot of concern, frankly. Paul in Pittsburgh, but thank you for the call. Paul in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Hi. Nice to hear from you.
Thank you.
I watch your show here on the PC because they turned it off at 1360 WTAE here in Pittsburgh with that Lynn Collin used to have it.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people want to hear it, but fortunately I got onto a talk show and on the radio.
In any case, that's not what you called about, Paul.
No, what I called about, though, I just want to let you know we're supporting you, that I called about here in Pittsburgh and in Pennsylvania. There's an organization called UPMC, University of Pittsburgh Medical Center. It's a conglomerate of hospitals and insurance companies. And they claim that they're private, nonprofit. Well, in the past two years, they profited $3 billion. They pay no taxes. They, in their magnanimity, give the city $275,000 to pay for their services. And there are only two other hospitals in this area, by the way, that are not owned by UPMC. But whenever the city or the state or the county start asking for more money, they threaten to take away the $275,000,
yeah.
actually. And all I'm saying is that it's privatized. They're making money, and they're not.
Well, here's the good news, Paul. They're not distributing that money to stockholders. They're not distributing that money. You may have some rather outsized CEO salaries there. In fact, it wouldn't surprise me at all if you got CEOs who are making, you know, in the neighborhood of a million or a little under a million, or maybe a little over a million. But you don't have somebody making 20 or 30 million. You don't have money going out to stockholders. That's the upside. The downside, as you point out, is that you have essentially monopolies forming, and you have nonprofits that are operating as if they were for-profit corporations in many regards, and being run by the same ethos, the same standards of conduct, and the same mindset as for-profit corporations, and that's very problematic.
Yes, and the community mental health organizations are also run on the same model. They're private yeah. corporations. They have a board of directors. Mm-hmm. For example, held our salaries 3 years without being raised. However, they raised the CEOs and the other people's salaries.
Yeah.
12%.
Yeah, well, that's my point. The mentality increasingly, and this goes back to Libby Dole, you know, Elizabeth Dole when she headed up the Red Cross. The mentality is increasingly, let's run these things as if they were for-profit corporations. And, you know, we really need to go back to the idea that not-for-profit organizations are here to serve the community. That's why they're there. That's why they get the special treatment.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Thanks for listening to the AM 620 KPOJ podcast, sponsored by the Better World Club. Providing travel services, auto insurance, and 24/7 nationwide roadside assistance, but not part of the highway lobby. This is Tom Hartman, Better World Club member since first moving to Oregon. Check out their eco benefits like the nation's only bicycle roadside assistance and their e-newsletter, Kicking Asphalt, at betterworldclub.com.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Reading our blog, the best way to reach me, instead of sending me an email, apropos of the conversation of spam, there's a lot of good discussions, actually, over at our blog. I read our blog every day at tomhartman.com. And Narlodia says, use Gmail. I rarely get any spam. Google knows everything. Gulp. And they know who is sending spam. You can report spam, and it gets removed from all Gmail accounts. It is a community endeavor. So, interesting. I understand that there is something like, it's called an enterprise account with Gmail, where I can have them be my mail server, even though it's tom@tomhartman.com. I'm going to have to look into that. So, lots of thoughts and suggestions. Thank you very much. 866-303-2270, our number. Alan in Berkeley, California. Hey, Alan, what's up?
Hey, Tom, I wanted to correct some misinformation, I think, that was on your show earlier about the bank
okay.
bailout.
Mm-hmm.
Bank of America, being a longtime shareholder of Bank of America and suffering quite a bit in the downturn, what Bank of America was required to do for the first bailout money, I haven't traced the second, is that they issued preferred stock
right.
to the government.
Right.
And over the next year, the government's going to receive somewhere around $1.5 to $2 billion in interest on that stock.
Right. And for our listeners who don't know what preferred stock is, let's just define terms here. Preferred stock is a class of stock that can or cannot vote, typically does not have voting privileges like common stock does, but it is first in line in the event of a bankruptcy, and it is required to pay dividends as long as the company's not bankrupt, and the amount of the dividend is fixed. Now, here's my problem with that, Alan. Warren Buffett cut the same deal, and I think with Bank of America, might have been with Citibank, it was one of the big banks, and for maybe it was $15 billion, and he got twice the interest rate on the required dividend that the federal government did. And, you know, so
right.
he got twice the deal we did.
It's not quite twice, but maybe that's on the second part.
Yeah.
But it was at the expense of common shareholders.
Yes,
I mean their stock dividends dropped from about $2.50 per share to 1 cent per share.
Yeah, because the preferred shareholders get the first dip of the dividends, and that comes out of the pool of profit. And if the pool of profit shrinks, then you know what's left to pay dividends.
Right. I'm not defending Bank of America here. I'm just saying that the concept that Bank of America received free money is not quite correct.
Okay.
And with regard the government also holds equity in Bank of America, which will eventually either be sold off to private investors or repaid by bank or bought back by Bank of America.
Yeah. That's
so
that's
the money
true
is more of a loan.
That's true of some percentage, some unknown percentage of the $350 roughly billion of TARP money that was distributed. We don't know, however, what percentage of that was used to buy common shares and what percentage of that was actually simply distributed to reinflate banks. For example, I believe AIG, I don't think that the government's holding a preferred stock in AIG, and yet they got, what, $35 billion? The bigger issue is the Fed. The Fed has passed out $2 trillion to the banking industry, and they refused a request from Congress to identify where that money went or what they got for it.
Right. I think it should be required that they do the right thing with the money. I'm not arguing that. I'm just saying that it isn't completely free, and the taxpayers are going to get some of their money back, if not all of it, at least in the case of Bank of America.
Right. Yeah. Point made, Alan, and well made. Thank you very much for the call. And frankly, this is where, you know, the Swedish example comes into play. What Sweden did was when their banks were failing a decade or so ago is they said, okay, that's it. They went in and they bought them up. They just bought the stock at market value and said, we own you now. And they fired the senior management of the banks, and they put bank regulators in who knew how the banks worked and had said, you're running the banks now. And they ran the banks back to profitability, took a couple of years. When the banks were profitable again, then they had an IPO, an initial public offering, and sold the banks back out into the private sector. And those banks are, again, private corporations, by and large. And that's what the British are doing right now. It's what they did with Northern Rock. It's what they did with the Royal Bank of Scotland. They acquired 100% of Northern Rock because it was essentially in bankruptcy. RBS, the British government owns 72% of. They have controlling interest in it. And that's what, frankly, in my opinion, we should be doing here. So, anyhow, is it Larry in Birmingham, Alabama? Am I pronouncing that right? Listening on
yeah, screen. It's Larry. How are you doing, Tom?
Hey, Larry, I'm great. How are you today?
I'm doing fine. You're the smartest man I know. I need your help.
Okay. How so?
When we bought our house, we had less than 20% to put down.
Right.
We were required to purchase mortgage insurance, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm assuming that everyone else that has, let's just call it a risky loan, that they also have to purchase insurance. So if all these mortgages are insured, what's the problem?
Now, you know, I guess I'm not as smart as you thought, Larry, because I know what title insurance is, but I don't know what mortgage insurance is. I don't, you know.
If you have less than 20% down,
right,
your mortgage lender very often requires you to purchase PMI, is what they call it.
Mm-hmm.
We pay our PMI premium every month.
Right. So that insurance pays off your mortgage if you don't? Is that the deal?
Exactly. That is to protect the lender in case we default.
Oh, that's interesting.
So my question is, you know, if these mortgages are insured, why are they considered toxic?
Right. That's a very good question, and I don't know the answer to it. I unlike Alan Jablonski, you know, who comes on, who's right in the middle of that kind of stuff. He's a licensed mortgage broker, and he understands that from that side of the table. And on my side of the table, I haven't had a mortgage in a lot of years. I've never encountered anything like that. So I just don't have the personal experience to answer your question, Larry. But I'll look around. I'll see what I can
find
out.
Thank you. Because I want to know why I'm paying for it if it's no good.
Yeah, and I'm wondering if the PMI or the private mortgage insurance or whatever it is, if that might be the first iteration of what are later known as credit default swaps and then later known as derivatives.
Exactly.
Because it's basically a bet against the mortgage. And if that's the case, maybe even the PMI has been sold and that's bankrupt. I mean, who knows? But I'm just speculating. So I'll stop there and I'll do a little research and we'll talk about it in a future show, okay?
Thanks, Tom.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the call, and it's an interesting question. And maybe one of, you know, maybe our listeners know, or maybe the folks in the chat room will give me a link on this. Courtney in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Hey, Courtney, what's on your mind today?
Good day. First time on your show. That was a very excellent question which that lady just asked, because I also had to pay that insurance when I had my FHA loan, but then after I refinanced and went conventional, meeting the 20% requirement, I was able to drop that. Hmm. The real reason why I called.
Courtney? Courtney has vanished. I'm gonna put Courtney on hold just in case it was his phone, and go to Harvey in Berkeley. Hey, Harvey, you're on the air. I'm not hearing Harvey either.
And a while back, I called
There's
you.
Harvey.
Tom?
Tom? Yeah, Harvey, go ahead.
Tom?
Yeah, you're on the air.
Liberal
Harvey?
Talk show. Yes, Tom?
Yeah, you're on the air, sir.
Tom?
Yes,
Tom?
Sir.
Congratulations on being number one liberal.
Thank you. Yeah, we're cutting in and out. We're gonna take a break here right now while we try to figure this out. I don't know if it's the new Gee Whiz discount phone company that we have or what. We'll find out. In the meantime, we're gonna take a break and try and check with all of our callers and make sure that they're all there and make sure that our phone system is working properly. And we'll be back with Anything Goes Friday. I also have to tell you the story when we get back of the Republican who beat Bill Jefferson down south, facing a recall. It's an interesting story.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Just a heads up on my travel schedule. Next week, I will be in Washington, D.C. Thursday and Friday at the Conservative Political Action Conference. That's always a load of fun. It's a barrel of monkeys or whatever the phrase is. In fact, I got an early announcement here. I will be able to purchase from the Mitt Romney folks the Obama Bin Laden Impeach Now bumper sticker at the CPAC. So, oh boy, is that going to be entertaining. So I'll be there on March 7th, which is, as I recall, it's a Saturday. Saturday, March 7th, we're doing the three-hour cruise with AM1090Seattle.com. On March 19th in Chicago, I'll be debating Michael Medved. That you can get tickets to at chicagosprogressivetalk.com. And on Saturday, May 2nd, I'll be in Denver, Colorado, keynoting the Green Festival. Information on that at greenfestivals.org/Denver. Yes, the Republicans are at it again. Louisiana Congressman Chao, I'm assuming it's pronounced Chao, C-A-O. Maybe it's Cao, I don't know. His name is Joseph An Cao, and he is the guy who beat Bill Jefferson. Remember the Democrat who had the $100,000 more or less in his wrapped up in tinfoil in his freezer? Well, this is the guy who beat him, the Republican who beat him, and he voted against the stimulus package, and the good citizens of his district in Louisiana have now initiated a recall petition. They are talking about recalling this guy for voting against the stimulus package. Okay, let's see if we can make the phones work again. Courtney in Fort Lauderdale. Hey, Courtney, you still there?
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, everything sounds fine now. What's up?
Okay, I was saying the Federal Reserve is still alive and kicking in good old America.
Yes, sir.
Woodrow Wilson, who signed the Fed into law, is dead.
Yeah.
Ronald Reagan, who did a lot of damage to the economy also, is dead. But I'm wondering how many more times you're going to mention Ronald Reagan's name before he's written from the dead, and why not Woodrow Wilson first?
Oh, I'll condemn Wilson for passing the Fed. You know, actually, the thing that I would condemn Wilson for is the, you know, reviving the Alien and Sedition Act. You know, Wilson passed, pushed through legislation and enforced it aggressively that gave him the power to put people in jail for speaking out. And he put into prison people who were opponents of World War One. And I think that was wrong. I'm no big fan of Woodrow Wilson, even though he was a Democrat. No problem criticizing both of them, frankly. And although with regard to the Fed, I suspect, I don't have any clue, and I don't think any of us do, that Wilson's support of the Fed was because he thought it was the best thing to do. Keep in mind, in the previous two decades, there had been three major financial panics, major crashes that didn't just wipe out the rich. They wiped out the average person as well, particularly the one of 1909 and the one of 1896. The panic of 1904 was called the rich man's panic. It really hit the, it kind of skimmed across the top. By the way, just got a note here in our chat room. This from Epicosis 23, if I'm pronouncing it right. PMIs, the private mortgage insurance, does not cover the full amount of the mortgage. In answer to the question from the caller before, it just covers that top 10 to 20%, and it's automatically canceled if your equity exceeds 20% of the loan. That's why it's not the salvation of the problem of people who have who are in default. So just so we all know. Harvey in Berkeley. Let's try. Whoops, wrong side of the board. Let's try this again, Harvey.
Hi, Tom.
Hey.
Congratulations on being selected as the number one liberal talk show host in America.
Thank you.
And a while back, I called you and I told you about an idea I had for a solar electric rechargeable battery, a battery with a photovoltaic surface that you put in the up on the windowsill and it recharges itself.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it turns out that if you Google the words SunCat, that's SunCat, that's one word, SunCat,
mm-hmm.
SunCat rechargeable batteries, it turns out that it's been done. And this gentleman took a nickel-cadmium battery and wrapped it in a solar cell. And there's pictures of it there. You can see how he did it. And this
Harvey, you should be asking for a royalty.
No, not really. I just feel happy to give it to America. But this will save.
I agree.
This will save billions of batteries from going into the landfills after a single use, and this will also save the grid from supplying energy to millions of batteries. So that's. SunCat rechargeable batteries. Check it out. Look it up yourself. It's fantastic.
Great. Harvey, thank you very much. Great to hear from you. By the way, I want another one of the posts on our blog today over at tomhartmann.com. Kai One says, I recall I was listening to a radio program in the early 80s. They were discussing stagnation. I think they were talking about stagflation. Until the late 1970s, stagnation was thought to be impossible, or stagflation. That's where the economy goes into a recession and you have inflation. In this discussion, they were saying that stagflation is caused by the way the Vietnam War was paid for. They said that LBJ paid for it by printing money and Nixon paid for it by borrowing. These two situations combined to screw up the economy in the 70s with inflation and debt. I've been thinking that this does not make sense because printing Federal Reserve notes is borrowing. Yesterday's discussion caused me to wonder if Johnson printed U.S. notes instead. Interesting question for Ravi Batra. I can tell you the answer. The printing of U.S. notes ended with Kennedy's death. And I have done a little bit of homework on that since our conversations yesterday, and I find the whole thing absolutely fascinating. Bernice in Dearborn, Michigan. Hey, Bernice, what's up?
You're mentioning Jack Kevorkian's lawyer, Jeffrey Feiger.
Yes, thank you for his name.
Gave me the perfect lead into what I was calling about. Nancy Pelosi has been at the Vatican, and it was reported that the Pope totally condemned physician-assisted suicide to her.
Right.
And we had a friend of the family who passed away in August who suffered so much at the end that he was begging for something like physician-assisted suicide.
Yeah.
And I just don't appreciate, theocratic lecturing to us.
Well, the Pope was offering his opinion, and he's the king or whatever. He's the Pope, I guess is the right word, of his own country, the Vatican, which has, as I recall, 538 citizens who are all male. And but oddly is a member of the United Nations and has a seat on the UN Population Council, on the group within the United Nations that determines population policy. I always thought that was a little strange. But, he has every right to his opinions, and a religion, a major world religion, has every right to hold their opinions. Nancy Pelosi, I suspect, she's a pretty diplomatic woman, I suspect, said, thank you very much for your opinion. I'll put it in my handbag and or whatever, I don't know. But Actually, there is no physician-assisted suicide in California. I think Oregon is the only state with it, so, and Washington now.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
Junk emails. Yes, indeed. Oh, it's the Bush family. What a friend we have in W. Oh, yes.
God wished him to be our leader. The court could not but follow suit.
And not just him. They wanted his daddy to be the leader. And they wanted his granddaddy to be a senator, Prescott Bush. And Prescott Bush, apparently when he was in Skull and Bones, went off and snatched Geronimo's skull, which is still used by the Skull and Bones Society as part of their initiation rituals at Yale University. And so Geronimo's great-great-grandson, Harlan Geronimo, 61, told reporters yesterday, "I believe strongly from my heart that his spirit was never released." They filed legal action this week on the 100th anniversary of Geronimo's death, demanding his skull back. The skull that was stolen by George W. Bush's grandfather. Give back the skull of Geronimo from Skull and Bones. There you go. Yeah. Oh, my. What a friend we have in W and his whole ilk. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Tim in Boulder, Colorado. Hey, Tim. Stephanie, should I use the left or right side of the board? Okay. All righty. Tim, what's up?
Hello, Tom.
Hey, Tim.
Let's see. There's a subject I'd like to turn you on to if you're not aware of it already. And you were talking yesterday, and you knocked my socks off when you were talking about Cartesian thinking being responsible for the mess we're in. Anyway, there's scientific evidence that getting ahead financially is largely a matter of luck. And I'd like to, as they say, turn you on to this subject.
I've read the study, or the studies, or at least one study that suggests that that's very much the case, that's the largest variable, actually. And, I mean, there are other variables that have to do with things like education, and obviously this is, you have to filter out whether you're born to wealth or not. But, yeah.
Have you heard of the Sugarscape study out of the Brookings Institution?
Not by name, if I have, I don't recall it.
Anyway, it comes out of this out of the idea of treating systems as a whole and having emergent behaviors coming out of the interaction of a network of parts.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really a stunning new area of economics as well as thermodynamics and genetics and so forth. And it just craters Milton Friedman's ideology. And,
yeah, it does all come together. Tim, any chance you could post a link to that information over at TomHartman.com on today's blog? I'd love to see it.
I can sign up and try. May I make one book recommendation?
Sure.
Okay. The title is Complexity, and the subtitle is The Emerging Science at the Edge of Order and Chaos. And the author's name is M, initial M, Mitchell, with spelled with a double L at the end.
Mm-hmm.
Waldrop. W-A-L-D-R-O-P.
Waldrop.
And okay. The Washington Post called it the most exciting intellectual adventure story of the year.
That's great. I just wrote it down. I will check it out. Tim, thanks so much for the call, and thanks for being among our thinkers here. I appreciate it, and I look forward to that link over at TomHartmann.com. I will check for that. Dan in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Dan, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I just called you because earlier you had a question. The lady called in and said, well, you know, all these mortgages have mortgage insurance, and why didn't it pay off?
Mm-hmm.
And basically, well, one of your major mortgage insurers in this country is AIG, one of the first people we bailed out.
Yeah.
So if people are wondering why the mortgage insurance isn't kicking in and taking care of this, it's because that's where we started.
Yeah.
We started at the top.
Yeah, and AIG was taking all that insurance money, and they were basically gambling it with it in derivatives. In fact, as Bill Seaman pointed out, they had, you know, what was it, 80 people, as I recall, or something like that, you know, a relatively small number of people in their London office. And they were doing it out of London because it was illegal in the United States, and just gambling billions of dollars, and they ended up trillions of dollars in the hole. And probably still are. Interesting, Dan. Thank you very much for the heads up on that. Amazing. Lewis in Seattle. Hey, Lewis, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I wanted to ask a couple things. First off, I wanted to ask if you had if you're rethinking any of the premise on your Kennedy assassination book in light of having those silver certificates printed up as opposed to the Fed notes.
Yeah, I think the bankers might have wanted him dead, but it's pretty clear to me that it was Carlos Marcello and Johnny Roselli and Santo Trafficante, and there's a pretty strong preponderance of evidence, not to mention the fact that two of the three of them have confessed to it, and Roselli, when he was talking about it, ended up with, you know, his body chopped into pieces with a chainsaw in a 55-gallon drum tossed into the bay, you know, in South Florida. So
Who paid him, though?
Well, actually, that story gets even more convoluted. Apparently, Jimmy Hoffa started the thing because he was all flipped out because Bobby Kennedy was coming after him. But you know, there's still a lot that we don't know. Let me just say that I don't claim, and Lamar doesn't claim to have all the answers by any means.
I think there were some tight friends in those groups.
Yep.
But I also want to mention a concept that I think of as the poverty industry,
mm-hmm.
and that there's a lot of people getting rich on keeping people poor.
Yeah, yeah, you're right. And I would, you know, I'd put the banks at the top of that list, particularly the credit card companies.
It's an industry.
Yeah, it is.
Thanks for what you do, huh?
Thank you, Lewis, and appreciate the comments. Joe in Tigard, Oregon. Hey, Joe, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Good morning. I just have a couple of questions. One is the government, you know, our government, and they all have health insurance, if mm-hmm. I'm not mistaken. Who pays for it? How much do they pay? What is their co-pays? And, you know, questions like that.
I can tell you the way it works for members of the House and Senate, because Bernie has explained it on this program back when he was in the House and when he became a member of the Senate, and that is that the federal government gives them their choice of insurers. There's a couple of different insurers that they can buy. Bernie uses Blue Cross Blue Shield, and they basically get the top of the line policy. Whatever Blue Cross Blue Shield's best policy is, that's what they get. And it's paid for by us, and whatever the deductibles are on it, those are the deductibles. And it's the same policy that probably, you know, the top of the line executives in American industry get.
Oh, okay. You know, just wondering, because I was thinking, hey, maybe they could cut a better deal or get something, you know, a little less expensive.
Yeah, yeah.
It is on our dime.
It is, we need to figure out a way to turn up the heat on this whole health care issue. I mean, Progressive Democrats of America, pdamerica.com is, or .org, is really on this thing. and more people need to be on it. We need to have a national single-payer health care system, a health insurance program. It would be part, a very significant and important part of the solution to the economic crisis that we're experiencing, and it would fulfill part of the original promise of America, as Thomas Paine talked about, as Harvey Kay talks about in his brilliant book, Thomas Paine and the Promise of America. You know, Thomas Paine in his books, The Rights of Man, laid out national health care as one of the things that should be there for all of us. So, you know, Joe, you raise a good one, and it's one we all need to be pushing on. John, it's Santa Rosa. Hey, John, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Just one little correction. Fortunately, Californians don't have open primary yet, fortunately.
Right.
As part of this budget deal, this one Republican state senator held the Democratic majority in a hostage because they need two-thirds, which is ridiculous. But what the proposal does is puts two amendments on the ballot that the voters will have to decide if they want an open primary. So people are going to have to go out there and vote against this. The bad thing is that Californians have already voted once for an open primary, but the California Supreme Court ruled it unconstitutional.
Which is why they have to amend the Constitution. Does it require a simple majority or a supermajority to amend the Constitution in California?
That I don't know.
Yeah.
But it's crazy that one group can vote in another party's primary to nominate their nominee. I mean,
I think it is too. Political, and the other side, the people who are in favor of it, who are generally Republicans, say, well, you know, it's just this is just democracy. Anybody should be able to vote. Why are you trying to restrict my right to vote? No, the bottom line is that the Republican Party, the Democratic Party, the Green Party, the Libertarian Party, they're clubs, essentially. And this is my club, you know. I'm a member of it. It's a political club, but it's a club. And it should be limited to our members. We, the members of that club, should get to decide who we are going to put forward as the guy that we want to put up for public office. Real simple.
Visit HartmanRadio.com for live streaming video of the Tom Hartman Program.
Special thanks to Louise Hartman, to my producer, to our executive producer, Sean Taylor, to Amy Winslow, to Stephanie Whiteman, to Shelley Osterberger, to Marcus Hillman and Michael McDonald, all the folks over at Air America, to Sue Nethercutt, the folks in our chat room, and Mike Toth, who does our audio archives on our website, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for listening. Thanks so much.
Condescending tribes making money selling wine.
Oh, time for our limbo alert.
Everybody hates my guts.
Hates his guts.
I'm offensive, I'm a bigot, I'm a fraud. Can you dig it? I'm a sexist, racist, homophobic, fat, pathetic cuts.
And now we find the liberals doing what they always do, and I've told you this, they always try to give me 50 milligrams of Vicodin instead of the 80s.
I'm not
That's right.
I really can't.
Well, here's Limbaugh yesterday talking about the liberals.
They are going to establish separate rules for themselves by which they live, such as they'll be able to not pay their taxes and work in government at high levels. They're not going to be subject to whatever greenhouse gas laws there are. They're not going to be subject to any of this sort of. They have, because they're too important, you see. And they all think they're part of the elite. But today, forget Democrat. These people are liberal socialists now.
Yes, the liberal socialists.
That each and every day, I'm an evil, rotten, egotistical snob. I'm the couple.
So, our limbo alert for the day. And we also have a winner today in our contest is the wrong word, but Sean, you want to tell us who wins a copy of Walking Your Blues Away, my book about, it's actually a book on therapy and psychotherapy and walking, and it's for our best spam suggestion of the day.
from one of the liberal socialists in the chat room.
There you go. Liberal socialist and proud of it.
This comes from Narlodius. Great name. Use Gmail. I rarely get any spam. Google knows everything, and they know who's sending spam. You can report spam, and it gets removed from all Gmail accounts. It is a community endeavor, and lots of use of the word spam there, too.
Yeah. Okay. Good. Good on you. Narlodius will be sending you a book, and thank you very much. Victoria Jones with us for the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com in Washington, D.C. Victoria, what's going on in the world today?
Well, Tom, there's plenty going on in the world today. Right at home, I just left the White House press briefing, and Robert Gibbs had a lot to say on a number of subjects, including on nationalization of the banks, on which he said, we strongly believe that the privately held banking system is the correct way to go as long as it's regulated sufficiently. And he said that was a very strong statement, and he repeated it, and he said that's as, you know, as strong a statement as I can make, to which Chip Reed of NBC said, well, why don't you just say we will not nationalize the banks? That's a stronger statement.
Right. And well, he said...
He said, I think that I've said a very strong statement.
Oh. Okay. I'm very emphatic about the fact that I'm emphatic about something that I'm not so emphatic about.
Exactly. So he wouldn't quite go there. He wouldn't quite go there. So it may mean something, it may mean nothing, but I'm sharing it with you because it happened.
Thank you.
So that's something that went on. Meanwhile, Hillary Clinton, our Secretary of State, is ticking off human rights groups as she does her overseas trip because of remarks that she made about China, in which she basically said, well, there's not much point talking about human rights and Tibet and Taiwan because we pretty much know what they're going to say.
And tragically, this is true. I'm reading a book right now called The Jaws of the Dragon about how China is... You know, the theories over the last 25 years of the people like Hillary Clinton's husband and Reagan before him and George Bush, both the George Bushes, was that as we opened ourselves to China and we shared our technology with them and we gave them, you know, and Google went over there and Yahoo went over there and Rupert Murdoch went over there and everybody's doing business in China, that China would become more democratic. And in fact, this author posits, it's the reverse. We're becoming more like the Chinese. We're becoming more tolerant of human rights abuses. We're becoming less open. We're becoming more like the Chinese communist dictatorship. And that's a process that, as long as we continue entangled with them, will continue. And it seems to me like Hillary Clinton is validating the thesis of that book.
Her point is that she feels that we have to deal with other issues, and that if we can deal with them on other issues, we can make progress on the global economic crisis, the global climate crisis, and the security crisis, and that we should press on those even if we can't work on the other issues.
Well, you know, there's a certain logic to that and a certain irrefutable logic to that, you know, that you get what you can get, but... And you have to prioritize. And the death of the entire planet right now, which is something, or at least the ability of humans to live on this planet, I think many of us anyway, would agree is probably a higher priority than even endangered species or endangered humans or human rights. But, you know, you can make a counterargument, and that is that the death of the planet is not something that the Chinese are going to address until there's some sort of a democratic process there. Now, then you can make a counter-argument to that, that, you know, no, they get things done very efficiently there, you know, with the fascistic state, essentially. So, I don't know. But anyway, I understand what she's saying. I disagree with it. I'm on the side of the human rights groups, but...
Understood. Yep. Meantime, Congress comes back next week to a long list of chores, including possible passage of D.C. voting rights. Senior Democratic aides saying that they're cautiously optimistic of passage. However... Republicans could be pushing amendments that are going to embarrass Democrats. Things like abortion and gun control could be tacked onto the D.C. voting rights bill. Yes.
Oh, we want our wedge issues back.
So who knows what is likely to happen to that?
You know, I don't even think those are the wedge issues anymore. I just don't think it's going to fly. I don't think immigration's going to fly. They've got to come up with some new wedge issue. You know, the gays don't make it. I think their day is past, Victoria.
You need to make it a poll question, Tom.
There you go. Victoria Jones, TalkRadioNews.com. Thanks, Victoria.
Thank you.
On Monday, I'll be talking to Roger Simon, CEO of Pajamas Media and the author of a new book, Blacklist Myself. He says he is being blacklisted, or Hollywood is being blacklisted by liberals now blacklisting conservatives. Plus, Carrie Lucas, do feminists in the media turn a blind eye to the abuse of Muslim women for fear of insulting Islam? That's an interesting concept, an interesting discussion. Don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Get out there, get active, tag, you're it. We'll see you on Monday. Have a great weekend.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit HartmanRadio.com.